Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home,
and she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning,
but that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months, and with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Hygge. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800.
She has 3 envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the Tiny Home Nation.
She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same.
Which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing.
If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.
Up from Slavery, Chapter 11, Making Their Beds Before They Could Lie on Them. A little later in the history of the school, we had a visit from General J.F.B. Marshall, the treasurer of the Hampton Institute, who had had faith enough to lend us the first $250 with which to make a payment down on the farm. He remained with us a week and made a careful inspection of everything. He seemed well pleased with our progress and wrote back interesting and encouraging reports to Hampton. A little later, Miss Mary F. Mackey, the teacher who had given me the sweeping examination when I entered Hampton, came to see us. And still, later, General Armstrong himself came. At the time of the visits of these Hampton friends, the number of teachers at Tuskegee had increased considerably, and the most of the new teachers were graduates of the Hampton Institute. We gave our Hampton friends, especially General Armstrong, a cordial welcome. They were all surprised and pleased at the rapid progress that the school had made within such a short time. The colored people from miles around came to the school to get a look at General Armstrong, about whom they had heard so much. The general was not only welcomed by the members of my own race, but by the southern white people as well. This first visit which General Armstrong made to Tuskegee gave me an opportunity to get an insight into his character such as I had not before had. I referred to his interest in the southern white people. Before this, I had had the thought that General Armstrong, having fought the Southern white man, rather cherished a feeling of bitterness toward the white South and was interested in helping only the colored man there. But this visit convinced me that I did not know the greatness and the generosity of the man. I soon learned by his visits to the Southern white people and from his conversations with them that he was as anxious about the prosperity and happiness of the white race as the black. He cherished no bitterness against the South and was happy when an opportunity offered for manifesting his sympathy. In all my acquaintance with General Armstrong, I never heard him speak in public or in private a single bitter word against the white man in the South. From his example in this respect, I learned a lesson that great men cultivate love and that only little men cherish the spirit of hatred. I learned that assistance given to the weak makes the one who gives it strong, and that oppression of the unfortunate makes one weak. It is now long ago that I learned this lesson from General Armstrong and resolved that I would permit no man, no matter what his color might be, to narrow and degrade my soul by making me hate him. With God's help, I believe that I have completely rid myself of any ill feeling towards a southern white man for any wrong that he may have inflicted upon my race. I am made to feel just as happy now when I am rendering service to southern white men as when service is rendered to a member of my own race. I pity from the bottom of my heart any individual who is so unfortunate as to get into the habit of holding race prejudice. The more I consider the subject, the more strongly I am convinced that the most harmful effect of the practice to which the people in southern sections of the South have felt themselves compelled to resort in order to get rid of the force of the Negro's ballot is not wholly in the wrong done to the Negro, but in the permanent injury to the morals of the white man. The wrong to the Negro is temporary, but to the morals of the white man, the injury is permanent. I have noted time and time again that when an individual purges himself in order to break the force of the black man's ballot, he soon learns to practice dishonesty in other relations of life, not only where the Negro is concerned, but equally so where a white man is concerned. The white man who begins by cheating a Negro usually ends by cheating a white man. The white man who begins to break the law by lynching a Negro soon yields to the temptation to lynch a white man. All this, it seems to me, makes it important that the whole nation lend a hand in trying to lift the burden of ignorance from the South. Another thing that is becoming more apparent each year in the development of education in the South is the influence of General Armstrong's idea of education, and this not upon the blacks alone, but upon the whites also. At the present time, there is almost no Southern state that is not putting forth efforts in the direction of securing industrial education for its white boys and girls, and in most cases, it is easy to trace the history of these efforts back to General Armstrong. Soon after the opening of our humble boarding departments, students began coming to us in large numbers. For weeks, we not only had to contend with the difficulty of providing board with no money, but also with that of providing sleeping accommodations. For this purpose, we rented a number of cabins near the school. These cabins were in a dilapidated condition, and during the winter months, the students who had occupied them necessarily suffered from the cold. We charged the students $8 a month, all they were able to pay for their board. This included, besides board, room, fuel, and washing. We also gave the students credit on their board bills for all the work which they did for the school, which was of any value to the institution. The cost of tuition, which was $50 a year for each student, we had to secure then and as now wherever we could. This small charge in cash gave us no capital with which to start a boarding department. The weather during the second winter of our work was very cold. We were not able to provide enough bedclothes to keep the students warm. In fact, for some time we were not able to provide, except in a few cases, bedsteads and mattresses of any kind. During the coldest nights, I was so troubled about the discomfort of the students that I could not sleep myself. I recall that on several occasions I went in the middle of the night to the shanties occupied by the young men, in the purpose of comforting them. Often I found some of them sitting huddled around a fire with the one blanket which we had been able to provide wrapped around them, trying in this way to keep warm. During the whole night, some of them did not attempt to lie down. One morning, when the night previous had been unusually cold, I asked those of the students in the chapel who thought that they had been frostbitten during the night to raise their hand. Three hands went up. Notwithstanding these experiences, there was almost no complaining on the part of the students. They knew that we were doing the best that we could for them. They were happy in the privilege of being permitted to enjoy any kind of opportunity that would enable them to improve their condition. They were constantly asking what they might do to lighten the burdens of the teachers. I have heard it stated more than once, but both in the North and in the South, that colored people would not obey and respect each other when one member of the race is placed in a position of authority over others. In regard to this general belief and these statements, I can say that during the 19 years of my experience at Tuskegee, I never, either by word or act, have been treated with disrespect by any student or officer connected with the institution. On the other hand, I am constantly embarrassed by the many acts of thoughtful kindness. The students do not seem to want to see me carry a large book or a satchel or any kind of burden through the grounds. In such cases, more than one always offers to relieve me. I almost never go out of my office when the rain is falling, that some student does not come to my side with an umbrella and ask to be allowed to hold it over me. While writing upon this subject, it is a pleasure for me to add that in all my contact with the white people of the South, I have never received a single personal insult. The white people in and near Tuskegee, to an especial degree, seem to count it as a privilege to show me all the respect within their power, and often go out of their way to do this. Not very long ago, I was making a journey between Dallas, Texas, and Houston. In some way, it became known in advance that I was on the train. At nearly every station at which the train stopped, numbers of white people, including, in most cases, the officials of the town, came aboard and introduced themselves and thanked me heartily for the work that I was trying to do for the South. On another occasion, when I was making a trip from Augusta, Georgia, to Atlanta, being rather tired from much travel, I rode in a Pullman sleeper. When I went into the car, I found there two ladies from Boston whom I knew well. These good ladies were perfectly ignorant, it seems, of the customs of the South, and in the goodness of their hearts insisted that I take a seat with them in their section. After some hesitation, I consented. I had been there but a few minutes when one of them, without my knowledge, ordered supper to be served to the three of us. This embarrassed me still further. The car was full of Southern white men, most of whom had their eyes on our party. When I found that supper had been ordered, I tried to contrive some excuse that would permit me to leave the section, but the ladies insisted that I must eat with them. I finally settled back in my seat with a sigh and said to myself, I am in for it now, sure. To add further to the embarrassment of the situation, soon after the supper was placed on the table, one of the ladies remembered that she had had in her satchel a special kind of tea which she wished served, and as she said she felt quite sure the porter did not know how to brew it properly, she insisted upon getting up and preparing and serving it herself. At least the meal was over, and it seemed the longest one though I had ever eaten. When we were through, I decided to get myself out of the embarrassing situation and go into the smoking room, where most of the men were by that time, to see how the land lay. In the meantime, however, it had become known in some way throughout the car who I was. When I went into the smoking room, I was never more surprised in my life than when each man, nearly every one of them, a citizen of Georgia, came up and introduced himself to me and thanked me earnestly for the work I was trying to do for the whole South. This was not flattery, because each of these individuals knew that he had nothing to gain by trying to flatter me. From the first, I have sought to impress the students with the idea that Tuskegee is not my institution, or that of the officers, but that it is their institution, and that they have as much interest in it as any of the trustees or instructors. I have further sought to have them feel that I am at the institution as their friend and advisor, and not as their overseer. It has been my aim to have them speak with directness and frankness about anything that concerns the life of the school. Two or three times a year, I ask the students to write me a letter criticizing or making complaints or suggestions about anything connected with the institution. When this is not done, I have them meet me in a chapel for a heart-to-heart talk about the conduct of the school. There are no meetings with our students that I enjoy more than these, and none are more helpful to me in planning for the future. These meetings, it seems to me, enable me to get at the very heart of all the concerns of the school. Few things help an individual more than to place responsibility upon him and to let him know that you trust him. When I have read of labor troubles between employers and employees, I have often thought that many strikes and similar disturbances might be avoided if the employers would cultivate the habit of getting nearer to their employees, of consulting and advising with them, and letting them feel the interest of the two are the same. Every individual responds to confidence, and this is not more true of any race than of the Negroes. Let them once understand that you are unselfishly interested in them, and you can lead them to any extent. It is my aim from the first at Tuskegee to not only have the buildings erected by the students themselves, but to have them make their own furniture as far as was possible. I now marvel at the patience of the students while sleeping upon a floor, while waiting for some kind of bedstead to be constructed, or at their sleeping without any kind of mattress, while waiting for something that looked like a mattress to be made. In the early days, we had very few students who had been used to used to handling carpenter's tools, and the bedsteads made by the students then were very rough and very weak. Not infrequently, when we went into the students' rooms in the morning, I would find at least two bedsteads lying about on the floor. The problem of providing mattresses was a difficult one to solve. We finally mastered this, however, by getting some cheap cloth and sewing pieces of this together so as to make large bags. These bags we filled with pine straw, or as it is sometimes called, pine needles, which we secured from the forest nearby. I'm glad to say that the industry of mattress making has grown steadily since then, and has been improved to such an extent that the present time it is an important branch of work which is taught systematically to a number of our girls, and that the mattresses that now come out of the mattress shop at Tuskegee are about as good as those bought in the average store. For some time after the opening of the boarding department, we had no chairs in the students' bedrooms or in the dining rooms. Instead of chairs, we used stools, which the students constructed by nailing together three pieces of rough board. As a rule, the furniture in the students' rooms during the early days of the school consisted of a bed, some stools, and sometimes a rough table made up by the students. The plan of having the students make furniture is still followed, but the number of pieces in the room has been increased, and the workmanship has so improved that little fault can be found with the articles now. One thing that I've always insisted upon at Tuskegee is that everywhere that should be absolute cleanness or cleanliness. Over and over again, the students were reminded in those first years, and are reminded now, that people would excuse us for our poverty, for our lack of comforts and conveniences, but that they would not excuse us for dirt. Another thing that has been insisted upon at the school is the use of the toothbrush. The gospel of the toothbrush, as General Armstrong used to call it, it is a part of our creed at Tuskegee. No student is permitted to remain who does not keep and use a toothbrush. Several times in recent years, students have come to us who brought with themselves almost no other article except a toothbrush. They had heard from the lips of the older students about our insisting upon the use of this, and so, to make a good impression, they brought at least a toothbrush with them. I remember that one morning not long ago, I went with the lady principal and her usual morning tour of inspection of the girls' room. We found one room that contained three girls who had recently arrived at the school. When I asked them if they had toothbrushes, one of the girls replied, pointing to a brush, "Yes, sir, that is our brush. We bought it together yesterday." It did not take them long to learn a different lesson. It's been interesting to note that the effect that the use of the toothbrush has had in bringing about a higher degree of civilization among the students. With a few exceptions, I have noticed that if we can get a student in the to the point where when the first or second toothbrush disappears, he, of his own motion, buys another, I have not been disappointed in the future of that individual. Absolute cleanliness of the body has been insisted upon from the first. The students have been taught to bathe as regularly as to take their meals. This lesson we began teaching before we had anything in the shape of a bathhouse. Most of the students came from plantation districts, and often we had to teach them how to sleep at night. That is, whether between the two sheets, after we get to the point where we could provide them two sheets, or under both of them. Naturally, I found it difficult to teach them to sleep between two sheets when we were able to supply but one. The importance of the use of the nightgown received the same attention. And for a long time, one of the most difficult tasks was to teach the students that all the buttons were to be kept on the clothes, and that there must be no torn places and no grease spots. This lesson, I am pleased to be able to say, has been so thoroughly learned and so faithfully handed down from year to year by one set of students to another that often at the present time, when the students march out of chapel in the evening and their dress is inspected, as it is every night, not one button is to be found missing.